I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:20 on Thursday, April 24th, 2025. We're here in room 120. Please mute cell phones today. Members present include Representative McCabe, who just temporarily stepped out, Representative Himshute, Representative Vice Chair Story, and myself, Representative Carrick. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator from the Juneau LAO is Zach Lawhorn. We've also just been joined by Representative Moore. Our committee aide today is my staff, Stuart Relay. Today, for consideration, we have one governor's appointee to the Alaska Police Standards Council and three bills on the agenda. We will take public testimony on HCR 2, a uniform rules abstention change from Representative Mears, and do two introductory hearings on HJR 10, a constitutional amendment from Representative Schrage, and HB 152 on an education head tax from Representative Galvin. The first item on our agenda today is consideration of governor's appointee to the Alaska Police Standards Council, David Ross. We have also just been joined by Representative Vance. I will ask our appointee to please introduce yourself, put your name on the record, and proceed with your testimony today.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is David Ross. I'm the police chief for the city of Kenai. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today for consideration from my appointment to the Alaska Police Standards Council. My appointment is for one of the four police chief positions on the council. I've been with the Kenai Police Department for almost 24 years, with almost nine of that as the police chief. My entire law enforcement career has been at the Kenai Police Department, where I have served as a police officer, an investigator, a sergeant, a lieutenant, and currently the police chief. I've lived in the Kenai area for over 53 years, since 1971. I've served on the Alaska Police Standards Council for the last 3 years, and I feel like during that time the council has performed valuable work, and I think for that reason I'd like to continue. I look forward to my role on the council to help address the need for a very professional and well-trained law enforcement workforce in Alaska. I'm honored to be considered for the position, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Ross, I have one question just to start us out. Is your appointment an appointment or a reappointment for this position?
It is a reappointment. I've served for approximately 3 years.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Ross? Representative Himshute?
Hello, Mr. Ross. I'm just curious if your DPS Basic Academy training was in Sitka.
It was in Sitka in 2001.
Did you enjoy it?
I would have.
It's a very paramilitary academy. I thought it did excellent training and excellent physical fitness and some of the other stuff I didn't enjoy as much, the being yelled at and the basic training type stuff. But it was a good experience overall.
Can only imagine, and I was only asking because Sitka is such a wonderful place. Thank you.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Story?
Thank you, Chair Carrick, and through the chair, thank you, Police Chief Ross, for your dedication and your service to Kenai. I had a question just based on a couple of comments that you, well, the comment that you made was you wanted to continue to serve on the Police Standards Council because you felt you were doing valuable work. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
You know, I think the primary issue the council faces is listening to cases where officers or corrections officers may lose their certification or have it taken away from them for misconduct. And I think it's critical in our profession to remove people that should not be in the profession, take away their ability to be in it, because it is hard on the law enforcement profession to have people in it that shouldn't be, as well as to evaluate those who should have a second chance and have not done something that can not rehabilitate them into the profession. So I think that's the valuable work. We've also evaluated regulations that would regulate police officers in the profession on what they can and can't do, or what you can and can't do to be hired as a police officer. So all those things, I think, are important work.
I thank you for that.
And Representative Vance?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Chief Ross, as someone who is an officer in the field and for a number of years and sitting on the council, what do you consider the most important training qualification for the council, and any recommendations on what needs to be changed? I know that some of the demands are changing, and I'm always looking at reducing some of the burden of what we expect out of our officers and having a realistic picture. So what is your recommendations for that?
You know, I think the Department of Public Safety does an excellent job at the academy to roll out the training and to continue to adjust for what new officers need. It's grown, I think, by a month since I went to the academy in 2001. So first of all, I would say I think that law enforcement in Alaska has done a good job in keeping up and training new officers. I think the Kenai Police Department is an accredited law enforcement agency. So we've done, I feel like, a good job of keeping up with in-service trainings and standards and policies and procedures. I think, the tools are available out there for law enforcement agencies. Some struggle more than others. But I think, by and large, the law enforcement in Alaska is keeping up with the standards, is keeping up with the training necessary. But I would say more of our year is devoted to training. More of our weeks and months are devoted to training to try to keep our people current.
Follow up. Would you mind being specific on what you feel is the bulk of the training? I know in speaking with troopers and police officers in my district that they deal with a lot of domestic violence and mental health issues more than anything, and those issues just continue to grow. Is that does that make up the majority of the continuing training, or are there other areas that the public generally doesn't interface with that is necessary?
Those are important components of training. Critical incident response, dealing with the mentally ill, dealing with domestic violence, or constant updated training. But so is use of force, use of the tools that officers have to use. We probably are facing more mental health issues than we have in the past, but I think maybe there in some places there's a few more tools available. There's these critical incident response teams that are starting to pop up in Alaska, with the Mental Health Trust helping to support some of those. Alaska's always struggled, clear back from when I started and before, with mental health capacity in the system to deal with those struggling with mental health issues. But I think that is a big component of our officer training, how to de-escalate those people and how to not use force, and we're continually training on that.
Thank you. Is there anything else that you feel that we need to know of what you hope to see in this next term of your appointment?
I guess nothing, no specific agenda stands out to me. I certainly think that retaining and recruiting law enforcement officers is a struggle, both in corrections and law enforcement across the state, and it's going to continue to be a struggle. And I think that maintaining high standards, even though it's hard to hire people, is critical, and maintaining high standards in the end, I think, will help us recruit and retain people if we have high standards in the profession and the state.
Thank you, Mr. Ross.
Thank you, and I just wanted to note for the record that Representative Holland joined us at 3:25 p.m. Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, I think it was last year we had legislation mandating cultural training for our police officers, and I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about who has been giving that cultural training, who's been advising on that.
So I believe that added it to the academy training. I'm not sure if it's been rolled out beyond that. I think we only have only had, I think, one person in our agency go through the academy since that time. So I, I'm not sure how that's been done at the academy.
Follow up.
Yes,
through the chair, do you see that as something that is needed, or is I personally think that something is needed not just at the academy. I mean, it's needed for all of us. Is that something you feel you should? And it's a and I just told you I thought it was important, but is that something that you feel that you could bring to the council on your police standards, if that is something that needs to be talked about and addressed?
I certainly think it's always an important topic. It's an important topic in Alaska. I think, you know, what I would like to see when we roll out requirements for training across the state, that it's not up to every agency in the state to kind of figure out what that means, but that the Department of Public Safety, that the Alaska Police Standard Council would roll out that training for everybody. Would roll out that in-service training, either an in-person in-service training or an online training for everybody. That's the struggle sometimes I see with assigning training at a state level. It's kind of left the discretion of 40 departments to figure out what that means rather than roll out the training itself. But I do think it's important.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ross, for your testimony today. I don't see any further questions. Did you have one, Representative Holland? No. Seeing no further questions for our appointee, I'm going to open public testimony on our appointee. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify on Mr. David Ross's appointment to the Police Standards Council? Seeing none and seeing none online, we are going to close public testimony on this nominee. And seeing no further discussion, in accordance with AS 39.05.080, the House State Affairs Committee held a hearing on the following appointee and recommends they be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. For the Alaska Police Standards Council, David Ross. A signature on the report does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of this individual during any future sessions. And we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the report. At ease. House State Affairs Committee is back on the record, and at this time we're going to bring back before the committee House Concurrent Resolution 2 from Representative Muir's office. We did hear this bill on Tuesday, and today we'll be taking public testimony. Representative Muir's is needed in Health and Social Services this afternoon, but before we get to testimony, I wanted to turn it over to Corey Alt from Rep. Muir's office to provide any additional information to the committee and answer questions.
Hi, for the record, Corey Alt, Staff Representative Muir's. Thanks to the chair and the rest of the members of the committee for your time today. So I just wanted to follow up briefly on a couple of the items from last session where we had some lingering uncertainty. So first, Representative Holland asked where in the bill the language is that says that this question should be put without debate, and that's on line 14. It reads, the question of granting permission to abstain shall be taken without further debate. Representative Holland also asked if the procedure under HCR 2 would apply to committee votes as well as on the floor. We had some confusion about this. The answer, I had a chance to speak with legal, is mostly no. So AS 2460-030G reads in part, a legislator shall declare a conflict of interest before voting on a question before a committee of the legislature and shall request to be excused from voting on a question before a house of the legislature. So the obligation of a legislator before the full house is to abstain from a vote on which there's a conflict. The obligation in a committee is only to declare. So the HCR 2 procedure would not typically be required in a committee, although I clarified with legal that a member could request to abstain, and in that case, this procedure would apply. Representative Vance and Chair Carrick also had some curiosity about the context around majority vote threshold. So I went through, there's a list in this legislative research report from the National Council of State Legislatures of the procedures for all 50 states. I think we went over this last time. There are 15 chambers across America that use a vote to determine whether a conflict of interest is legitimate. 12 of those follow a majority threshold, and three That's the New York State Senate and both houses of the Kansas State Legislature use a two-thirds threshold. A little bit of history in Alaska. So this rule came into place in 1969 under the current unanimous consent threshold. Prior to that, in the territorial legislature, we had a procedure similar to the one outlined under HCR 2, where a conflicted member would ask to be excused, and then the majority of the body would excuse them or not, as the case may be. In 1967, that rule was changed from a majority threshold to a two-thirds majority threshold. And then in 1969, we went to the current unanimous consent threshold. Legislative research was unable to find information about the reasoning behind those rule changes at the time. I regret that I'm not able to provide that for the committee today. Lastly, Representative Holland requests information about other states' requirements to have written follow-up for conflict of interest declarations. And there are, you can find them in the legislative research report. Those states are Arizona, Florida, Idaho, Kentucky, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Texas, and Utah. Any further questions from the committee?
Thank you for the robust follow-up. Looking around for questions one more time in case I see any. We'll also ask one more time at the end. At this time, I'm going to open public testimony on HCR 2. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify on House Concurrent Resolution 2? Seeing none and seeing no one online, we're going to close public testimony on HCR 2. And one last call for any questions from committee members. Rep. McCabe, anything?
I'm good. Thanks.
I am going to set an amendment deadline for HCR 2 for Monday, April 28th at 5 p.m. It's this coming Monday, April 28th, 5 p.m., and we'll also email that out to committee members. At this time, we will set House Concurrent Resolution 2 aside for a future hearing. And we will transition right into the next item on our agenda today, which is House Joint Resolution 10 on constitutionalizing the POMV from Representative Shragi. Today we're going to hear an introductory presentation from Representative Shragi and his office and have a presentation from the Permanent Fund Corporation. So I'd like to welcome Rep. Shragi and your staff, Amanda and Demo, to the House State Affairs Committee to proceed with your introduction.
All right. Thank you, Chair Kirik, members of the committee. Pleasure to be before you today. Thank you for your scheduling of HJR 10. With your indulgence, I'll have a very brief presentation just to, for the public and for members of the committee, outline what this joint resolution is, and then pass the torch over to Mr. Devin Mitchell of the Permanent Fund Corporation to go into a more detailed presentation on the proposal. So hopefully everyone has the slides up in front of them. HJR 10 is a resolution proposing amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to the Alaska Permanent Fund and the appropriations from the Alaska Permanent Fund. There are four sections to the bill. The first section, or Section 1, amends Article 9, Section 15 to specify that all income from the Permanent Fund is retained in the fund. Section 2 amends Article 9, Section 15 by adding a new subsection that limits appropriations from the fund to 5% of its average fiscal year-end market value of the fund for the first five of the preceding six fiscal years. Section 3 amends Article 15 by adding a new section that deposits the unencumbered balance of the earnings reserve account into the fund when the constitutional amendment takes effect. And Section 4 places these constitutional amendments on the ballot in the next general election. That is very simply what the joint resolution does on a high level. I would note that this was put forward recognizing that the Permanent Fund Corporation has been recommending this change for years. And I know that this isn't an issue of great importance to the legislature and, frankly, in my view, to the entire state of Alaska. And I look forward to having the committee hear from, again, Mr. Devin Mitchell of the Permanent Fund Corporation.
Great, thank you. We will take that presentation, I think, and then open it up for questions afterwards. So at this time, I'm just going to take a brief at ease so we can get set up for the presentation. At ease. House State Affairs Committee back on the record. Thanks to our secretary, Mr. Lawhorn, back there for the assist. And I want to welcome our Permanent Fund Corporation folks. If you could please introduce yourselves and then proceed with our presentation today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for the record, my name is Devin Mitchell. I'm the CEO and Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I have with me our Chief Investment Officer, Marcus Frampton. In a state affairs hearing maybe 6 or 8 weeks ago, heard, I think, Representative McCabe indicate that he had some questions about performance. And so even though this joint resolution isn't about performance, I thought it was important to provide some context just for the committee based on that request. And so there's an appendix to the presentation which includes performance information that Mr. Marcus Frampton would be able to provide as much or little detail on as you prefer. So we can jump to that if questions come up during the course of the presentation or as their time allows. So I think on the cover we've incorporated three words: respect, protect, and provide, and that summarizes the concept that's before the committee today. It's a matter of respect for the forefathers and mothers that created the permanent fund through a constitutional amendment in the 1970s. The second component of that is protecting that the sacrifice of each generation of Alaskans since 1978, when the state started spending or saving money in the permanent fund, wasn't so that one generation of Alaska could have an outsized benefit at some point in the future. And so that's currently embedded in the construct that we have. There's a vulnerability to one generation of Alaskans taking more than what might be a fair share. And that's similar to, in my mind, if you were a fisher or a hunter, and instead of taking what the Board of Fish or Game might recommend as a sustainable harvest, that you took more than that. Your generation essentially taking more than they should to impair the ability of future generations to enjoy those same benefits. And then finally, to provide. So the current construct also has vulnerabilities to the potential of inability to provide an annual transfer that the state now relies upon for both the permanent fund dividend as well as many other state services. And that vulnerability for what in the current year is shaping up to be something around 60% of unrestricted general fund revenue is untenable. And so this amendment, or this constitutional amendment, would provide an ability to resolve that issue, as well as the other two components I just went through. So a little bit of history. The fund, of course, was created in 76. This was after the lease sale in 69, generated $900 million for the state of Alaska. In today's dollars, relative to the budget of the day, that would be something between, depending on how they calculated that, if that was total budget, including federal revenue, that was $150 million back in that time frame, you'd say that that's something akin to the balance of the permanent fund showing up today in a lease sale bonus payment, which would be absolutely phenomenal. Of course, all our worries would be solved as far as monetary issues go, but the reality was, even though that seemed like a insurmountably large amount of money, that it was largely spent by the mid-1970s and fully spent by the late 1970s, and the residents of the day and leaders of the day recognized that that potential had the ability to repeat itself with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline nearing completion. The residents of the state were asked to consider saving a portion of current year revenue for future generations of Alaskans, and that resulted in a constitutional amendment being passed by almost two-thirds of the residents of the state, which is an extraordinary majority. And there's three basic components to that amendment. First, that we save money. So we save 25% basically of royalty revenue off the North Slope. There's other revenues that go in there. That's just the primary source. Second, that we invest that money to earn income. And third, that all that money become available for expenditure. The state decided to wrap that. All the money gets sent to the general fund with a statutory framework that provides for retention of earnings. If the state hadn't done that and had instead spent the money, our permanent fund wouldn't be $80 billion, it would be $20 billion. So the proposed single fund endowment model is merging the earnings reserve account, which is where the realized earnings of the permanent fund live, merging that account into the principal account. And right now we'll get into more detail in a moment, but there are a lot of moving parts and a lot of complexity with the current structure and some outdatedness that it doesn't conform well to current investment strategy and accountancy rules. And so you wind up with mismatches and money that kind of sloshes around and a lot of misunderstanding about what's principal and what's earnings reserve account. Just to answer that question, what is the principal? It's $59 billion. There's $80 billion in the fund. What is the earnings reserve account? If you look at our account or at our website, you're going to see something like $10 billion available in the earnings reserve account, but it's not really $10 billion that's available, and it's due to those things that I mentioned a moment ago, and we'll dive into that in a future slide. What's being proposed is a simplification of the structure that we currently have, where you'd have contributions into the permanent fund, the same contributions that we have today, that those monies would be invested to generate income, and then we'd have one payout. It would eliminate the potential of one generation taking more than their fair share through an overdraw of the permanent fund. It would also eliminate the potential of a shortfall for any generation not being able to provide for the needs of that year. And so from the trustee's perspective, a significant improvement. This slide shows the current construct, so obviously a lot more parts to the two different wheels that are in here, so money coming in, and then it's a portion of the principal is constitutionally protected, a portion is unrealized gains, and sloshes back and forth between the principal and earnings reserve account. There's income-producing investments in both accounts. The earnings reserve account is all subject to appropriation, but there's components of it that, again, are unrealized. And then there's manual levers that need to be pulled by the legislature to ensure that the earnings power of the permanent fund is maintained through inflation-proofing appropriations and then a fiscal discipline to ensure that there's not an overdraw. As far as the composition of the two accounts, this is getting to what I was speaking to earlier, that you have a stated value in the principal, $70.6 billion, but that's not actually what's take it to the bank principal. That's just an accountancy number based on the allocation of unrealized gains, because unrealized gains don't fit into the construct of this current framework. So there's $11.9 billion of unrealized gains that are categorized as principal, but those earnings, unrealized earnings, would actually shift over to the earnings reserve account to the extent that they are realized, which you would expect at some point. Some assets are very long-lived, and so unrealized gains can sit on the books for long periods of time. On the $10.2 billion in the earnings reserve account, sounds like a lot, and then you start breaking it down by how it's going to be used. We have $3.8 billion that you guys are using to fund the operating budget that you've been discussing recently. There's $1 billion in the current budget for inflation proofing. And then there's $1.7 billion of unrealized gains. Again, that money sloshes back and forth proportionally between the two funds based on balance. And so it disappears to the extent you spend the other money. That leaves $3.7 billion. This is as of March 31st, of spendable earnings that's in place to provide for the FY27 POMV draw. That's where the 27 POMV draw and any inflation proofing that might be appropriated for FY26, inflation proofing for 26, is estimated to be something in the $1.6 billion range. Whether or not that'll be appropriated just based on some of the stressors that we've seen in the earnings reserve account might be less likely. So in any event, it sounds like a lot when you look at the total balance and then you start breaking it down and you say, okay, we have enough basically to provide for the needs of the budget that we're going to be budgeting next legislative session if we earn another $300 million. So we're pretty close to the point of earning money in the year that we're going to be appropriating the money. As far as the impact of the POMV, first of all, I guess the formula is on the left, and so it's a smoothed draw that's based on a five-year historical average balance, so the last five completed fiscal years. Average balance, 5% is the draw, and you can see the calculation there for FY26, $3.8 billion. The projection for FY27 is $4 billion. So on the right-hand side, you can see the extraordinary benefit of the POMV structure and to the state's revenue stream that prior to 2019, the primary revenue generator for the state of Alaska's unrestricted general fund revenue was oil. The price of oil and production from the North Slope were the two variables that determined 85-95% of the state's unrestricted general fund revenue. And that had incredible volatility embedded in it based on oil price volatility. So you see big spikes and valleys. Those were successfully filled, this light blue. Those were successfully filled. If we could, it doesn't show it on this chart, but you'd be able to superimpose the use of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund to fill in the voids in the years following, 1994 or so. And so that became the initial shock absorber for the state. That became overstressed in the period following 2014's oil price decline, and we saw a need to shift to a POMV to continue to provide sufficient revenue to the state of Alaska to provide for the needs of the state, residents, and the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund at this point as a balance that's not sufficient to continue to provide that shock absorber effect without a POMV structure. This shows the earnings reserve account, the current construct. It's kind of I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth a little bit, so don't judge me too much. But the current construct has a requirement that in order for money to become spendable in the earnings reserve account, it has to be realized income. So if you get a dividend on a stock, if you get an interest income on a bond, if you have a rent on a property, if you sell something that's increased in value, that increased value, those things are income that go into the earnings reserve account and become spendable. That balance has been decreasing over the course of this graph on the left-hand side of the page from fiscal year 19 through 24 and into 25, where you went from a $12.9 billion balance declining and hanging tough around the $5.5, $6 billion range, and then declining again through 24 and 25. And so at the same time that you saw this declining balance of spendable amounts in the earnings reserve account, there's been there's been increases in the unrealized gain category of earnings of the permanent fund. And so there's a mismatch between some of the asset allocations that we have in the portfolio that are intended to maximize return but don't necessarily generate realized income at the same pattern that you might expect from a bond that people might have been thinking about back in 1976 when you could buy a bond that paid you a 10% coupon rate. So it's a different investing environment and different types of revenue that are generated, and some of the revenue that's generated at this point isn't spendable in the construct we have, and that's creating stresses. And FY25 was the first year since the percent of market value era that there's been an inability to provide for the coming year's POMV transfer. So we commit We have a conservative construct where we commit the coming year's POMV transfer as soon as we know what it is, and there was a $400 million deficiency this year. That money was earned during the year in addition to the $3.7 billion that was reflected on the prior slide. The need for reform in this construct is pretty clear. The one primary argument that I've heard against the idea of a combining of the accounts and moving to a true POMV structure is the potential of invading principle, that you would have a series of, I don't know how many years it would have to be, but a number of years where you would have low or negative earnings that the draw rate would exceed, and you would have a gradual diminishment of the principal balance of the fund. And there are scenarios where you could obviously have periods of time where you would have invasion of what quote-unquote principal might be construed as today. But if you think about what's actually available to the legislature today, and while it would take some levers to be pulled and there would be legal determinations required, those unrealized earnings that we have in the fund, there's different legal theories out there that they may be spendable to the extent they're either allocated to the earnings reserve account now or could be allocated to the earnings reserve account. And so that being the case, you would say 27% of the fund could be appropriated today by a single generation of the state of Alaska, which, again, would fail to conform to respecting the sacrifice of each past generation of Alaskan that didn't spend as much money as they could have on their current needs to provide for a future of our state. To spend that in a frivolous fashion, to me, would not conform to the contract, the social contract that may exist in our state. So in any event, the current construct actually has, in my view, a potentially greater potential of invasion of something that we currently call principal. If you think principal $70 billion, well, it's really 59, and that the balance of that money may really be spendable, again, if certain levers were pulled, versus a construct where you don't have a risk of a potential failed ability to provide a transfer because of a construct that doesn't properly identify earnings, current year earnings, based on our investment portfolio of the day. You would be limited to a $3.8 billion draw if the construct proposed was actually in place today. And I think we've talked about the benefits of the single fund model, that it does those three things that I referred to earlier, respects, protects, and provides for the state needs. And you know, there's been constitutional amendment support from the Board of Trustees for over 20 years, so many iterations, many governors that have been appointing trustees, that they've all supported the concept of moving towards a true endowment model where you have a simplification and collapsing of the two-fund structure we currently have into a single fund with a defined percent of market value transfer to be made available for the state's needs. And to that point, we had a trustee paper. The trustees had this paper drafted by Milan Rietveld, a known expert in sovereign wealth fund management around the world. And in it, he identified the constitutional amendment as one of the solutions. He had a couple of other solutions that are less durable. So there are alternatives, statutory alternatives. Obviously, statute can be changed a lot easier than the Constitution. And so that's good and bad. I think that's why the board historically has supported the constitutional change, is because it is an opportunity for this generation of Alaska to look back at the history of the past and the sacrifices that Alaskans have made to create this fund, and pivot towards the future and recognize that there's been changes in how money's invested and how money's accounted for, and provide a framework to take us forward through the next 50 years so that the state will continue and our children and grandchildren will continue to have the benefits of a permanent fund that pays regular recurring fair share amounts that's, again, similar to a maximum sustainable harvest on the land. And that's just a recap. This is obviously our most important point, that it's the simplification of what we've got right now into something that would provide for the future. And then we can talk about performance if we have time. Tried to kind of skip through there fairly quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. And I do want to open it up for questions because we will have to wrap up this introductory presentation in about 10, 15 minutes or so. Do we have questions from committee members? Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. I'm just curious about your thoughts about the POMV percentage. I think this is going to be proposed as 5% in there, and I've looked at 5% personally and thought that's maybe pushing it in terms of the longevity. Should it be 4%, 4.5%, something that's got a little more safety margin in it in terms of a long-term investment versus kind of pushing the envelope on there? And I'm just wondering what your thoughts and what the trustees' thoughts are on that percentage and how you view the recommendation at 5% or if it should be different.
Through the chair, Representative Holland, I think that Marcus might have some views on this as well, but from my perspective, if you look back historically, 5% is a target that's difficult to achieve, and that it's, in my view, what probably should be a maximum rate. If there was an interesting presentation given in Senate Finance this morning that Legislative Finance put together, Alexi Painter and Connor Bell, and they had done a lot of modeling in that, which was kind of interesting. It showed the difference between a 5.5% draw and a 4.5% draw, and the convection point was about 22 years, where you started seeing greater amounts being paid from a 4.5% draw than a 5.5% draw with linear upward ascending performance assumptions. But there was quite a bit of useful information, I thought, in the modeling they did that would, I think, it's all, you know, it's difficult when you're starting at any given point because you don't know, the next 5 years are so impactful in any modeling that you might do on an endowment structure. So if you're at a good starting point and you have 5 good years, then you can absorb a lot of loss. If we have 3 bad years right out of the gate, it creates a hole that you're digging yourself out of. And so it just depends on where you believe you're starting from and the experience that you have in particular in the short term after you start. But I don't know, Marcus, if you had thoughts on the 5%. And certainly our Board of Trustees haven't opined. They've said that that's a policy call for our elected officials to consider. We want to inform you that it's maybe a not to exceed target from a historical perspective, but ultimately we'll do what you say.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Holland, I believe it's a draw that's workable. I've been at the fund for 13 years, and our target return that entire time has been inflation plus 5%, even before we had the PMMV draw. So that's always been the goal, and there always have been 2-year, 3-year periods where maybe there's a bear market or inflation's high where we'll underperform that return. And so it can be a frustrating target, very short term to measure against. But if we look as of March, we've beaten it on a 5-year and a 10-year. And I think if we look back since the history of the fund on rolling 10-year periods, about half the time we're above, half the time we're below. So I think you framed it well, Devin. It's a common draw rate if you look at a university endowment, so it's not unusually high.
Okay, thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah, so staying through the chair, staying on that POMV, when you consider the 5-year, 6-year smoothing period, this microphone sucks. the 5-year smoothing period, it's really the draw is more like 4.5% than 5%, right? So, I mean, a 5%, if it was just a 5% every straight year without the smoothing period, like we do our retirements or something. It's a little bit different with the smoothing. It's more like 4.5 or even a little bit under that. At one point, one model I saw from Lexi was under 4, like 3.75 or something like that. So I don't know. Maybe you can confirm that, because it's vague in my memory from the fiscal policy working group.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative McCabe, that dynamic is at play. Although, if you get in a period like 08 where the market goes down, then the effective draw rate's above 5. But it's a nice correcting feature, because when markets are strong, the effective draw is low and the forward return is low when markets are strong. And then if you get in a real washed-out market, that your expected return's higher because stocks are cheaper and the effective draw is higher. So I think you're correct to point out that it's a mitigating factor.
Thanks. Yeah, let's hope the last month isn't an indicator of where we're going.
Sure. Representative Vance.
Thank you. Through the chair, it's easy to understand, you know, combining everything into one pot, have the percent of draw that goes into the general fund. But what happens if we don't make that change in the next 10, 20 years? What's the health of the earnings reserve and the corpus look like moving forward? Because we know that there's been continued appropriations of $1 billion up to, I forget, number of years ago, it was several billion to inflation-proof the fund that has drained the ERA, but it's also really helped the corpus. So has there been modeling done of, if we continue on the path that we're at for the next 10, 20 years of the health of both of those funds?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, we have, and so has legislative finance, and those models have shown a probability of ERA failure, meaning that the ERA would reach a point where you would have to rely on current year earnings to provide for the transfer to the state of Alaska to some degree. And current year earnings can be negative, and so you could wind up with a failed ability to provide for the revenue needs of the state. And so Marcus has a model, our consultant Callan put something together. Like I said, legislative finance put something together, and our CFO put something together, and all of them, to varying degrees, showed this probability existed sometime. Again, this is probabilistically, not meaning it's a requirement, because markets are markets, and we don't know what they're going to be in the future, but that there would be a failure of that sort sometime in the next 6 years.
Follow-up?
The next 6 years?
That's correct.
That's a hot minute around here. I have a lot of concerns. I know we've seen this proposal probably every term, but I think the reason that I've generally opposed it is that I have a constituency that still does not like the PONB model. But I think it caught everyone's attention with the idea that we would drain the ERA and really put us at a greater risk, because there's no more backstop. So is there anything else that that constituency needs to see in this equation? If this bill were to pass and it were to go before the people, what would be the one thing that you would say to the constituency who still says, no, we like the traditional formula, we don't like the PONB model? What would you say to them?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, maybe the three words I said earlier, but to some degree, those three words, that this is about respecting what you, if you lived here, right? You gave something up. You didn't have a school book. You didn't have a school activity. You didn't have a road plowed. You didn't have a capital project. Something you could have had, you didn't. And so why did you do that? You didn't do that so that this thing would fizzle out and somebody in the future would get something that might not be sustainable. You did it so that our state would have the means for success in the long term. And I think some people get caught up in the they get caught up in the permanent fund dividend transfer payments and the POMV, the shift away from the historical formula was perceived as this was the enabling moment. And this has nothing to do with the permanent fund dividend. This is just saying that we're going to be able to provide money for a permanent fund dividend every year. So maybe that would resonate with your constituency if that's their issue, that this isn't trying to say that somebody shouldn't get a formulaic permanent fund dividend. It's saying that we want to make sure that there's money each and every year, that we don't have the ability to spend more than our fair share, that so that the future doesn't have a share, and that we respect the people in the past that gave us this gift.
Thank you.
And I see we have a couple more questions. I'd also put myself in the queue. I was just hoping you could comment a little bit further. There have been some recent, and I know ongoing, concerns about the risk with a single account structure of overdraw of the principal. But that seems like a pretty outsized possibility from the presentation. And can you juxtapose that risk against the relative risk of overdrawing or overspending maximum POMV values under the current scenario? We've been talking a little bit about the health of the ERA, and just talking about the relative risk of those two things, because that's where some of the pushback comes from, is we shouldn't do this because we might risk drawing into the principal. But is that a greater concern, in your opinion, than the risk we take right now with a two-account structure?
Madam Chair, we went back to this slide that shows that what is protected as principal in the permanent fund right now is $58.7 billion. I don't think that's going to increase next year. I think it's going to be $58.7 billion still, and maybe the year after that as well. So if somebody's concerned about the principal, well, they're concerned about $58.7 billion. And how many years would we have to spend on an $80 billion fund to get to $58.7 billion with no earnings? So you'd have to have an experience of negative earnings, which you would have negative earnings. If you had a negative market experience and you lost value, your investments went down in value, that would happen with the current construct just like it would happen with the new construct. And so if there was a 20% correction and the fund went down 20% of value, the same thing's going to happen in either one of these scenarios. You're still going to have the ability to spend. A good example is statutory net income, realized income in 2022 was $4.5 billion-ish. And if you looked at the rate of return on the fund that year, it was negative 1.2. So there's already big disconnects between money coming in and what is earnings and what is principal and how are we going to protect the fund. And right now, I would argue that it's actually more vulnerable because of that complexity and confusion about what is what than if you shift it over to this thing where you go, oh, I can see what's principal, I can see what a draw rate is. And if my floor was $58, $59 billion, well, I can, when we get through that floor, because we had 10 years of negative 10% performance or whatever it would take to get to that point, you would know you would have been there anyways. In the other model, you just would have had revenue to the predictability of revenue and the opportunity to make change at that point.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just wanted to get that a little more clearly stated on the record. Representative Hemshoot and then Story.
Thanks. I'm a teacher, not an investor. So, through the chair, the last month has been very turbulent in the market. What does that mean for us down the road? So much of our budget depends on what you do. So, what happens next? And I know, you know, not asking for the crystal ball of what's happening with the market, but what is the impact of where we've just been? Does one month have a huge impact or not?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, it's been a volatile market. I mean, this month alone, at the beginning of the month, the stock market was down 10% on 2 days, which is a dramatic decline, but not, I mean, it's in like the top five most dramatic declines, but there was a day in 1987 when the market was down over 20% in one day. The thing that was particularly unusual that's alarming is that Treasury bond yields were going up as the market was going down, and like typically you see the opposite. People kind of or investors moving money into government bonds to protect themselves, but there's money coming out of government bonds and stocks and going into things like gold and other assets. So it's been an unusual market, but the market's rallied back almost to where it was at the beginning of the month. We've benefited because we bought stocks pretty aggressively on those 2 days, and through today, I think we're up about 5% on the year. And around December, we got some criticism for our performance. The biggest driver was we were underweight these like very expensive tech stocks like Tesla and Nvidia, and that's played out as we hoped. So it's been a profitable year, and the market's not down that much given the bounce back. So we're feeling pretty good, but it's a very uncertain outlook. And I think the important thing that we're doing is trying to manage to inflation plus 5 over the next 10 years. And I think I'm as confident as we've been before because we're so diversified and so global that a lot of the things that lagged U.S. tech stocks are now helping. And I think we can hit those returns that people rely on.
And Madam Chair, Representative Hemshue, just to bring it to a higher level, because that's definitely the inside baseball explanation, is just that we have an asset allocation that's not designed to hit home runs. So we're designed to hit singles and avoid outs just as much as we're trying to get on base for the baseball fans. Mm-hmm. And so the portfolio isn't going to do as well as certain asset classes at any given time, but it's not going to suffer as much. We're going to be more steady, hitting our target rate of return with less volatility, less deviation from that target. So less high highs, but less low lows. And that's played out exactly as Marcus described.
Follow up? Thanks. Through the chair, I'm working really hard to understand the fund and how it works. And there was a suggestion to go high risk and try to really grow it. How would that have played out given the downturn we just had? Because you just, if I understood you right, we do kind of safe investing, not high risk investing so much. Would that have, and you know, again, I'm asking for your expertise since I don't have it, but would that have been problematic for us if the board had gone that way?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hemshute, one of the things I like is that we do this every 4 or 5 year strategic planning, and we throw out a lot of different ideas and kick them around. And actually, everyone in our industry has been asking the same question: how do we hit higher returns? And private equity has been the place to be for the last decade. And we've seen Yale Endowment, for example, went big into private equity and got out over their skis. They're now, because they're losing federal funding, doing like essentially forced sales of illiquid positions. So I'm pleased that we concluded to have at a reasonable level of private equity, and I think the diversification that the board ended up with is really benefiting us now. So we looked at a lot of different things, and I don't, you know, I think we ended up at the right, the board ended up in the right place. So.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see, I think we had a couple more questions. Representative McCabe and then Holland, and then we're going to set the bill aside afterwards.
Thanks. Yeah, so you ended up the right position. The last month sort of indicated you guys, and that's awesome. What I'm curious of is, will the single fund make you more or less nimble? I mean, I think, Devin, I heard you say that your goal wasn't to be nimble enough to create a problem on the other end or to try to hit a home run and hit an out, right? Mm-hmm. But at some point, you still have to be nimble to take advantage of the first 2 days of this downturn. So single fund, more or less, we'd be able to set aside more money maybe for private equity to create a little piece of I don't know, nimbleness is the wrong word, but a little bit more flexibility?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe. That's an interesting question because the situation that Marcus just described with Yale was maybe where they were a little bit more aggressive. Private equity has been the highest performing asset class of the permanent funds portfolio, but it's highly illiquid. And so if you need money to pay your bills, you got to sell something, right? Or if you're not getting money from your investments sufficient to pay your bills, you're in a bad spot, and they're in a bad spot right now where they're trying to sell a house that's half built, and nobody wants to be in that situation. And so to the extent we had a one fund system, would that significantly change the asset allocation of the fund? I would argue that it wouldn't, because we would have to retain our hold on liquid markets, and so that could be public equity. I mean, we've seen an extraordinary 10-year run in the U.S. public equities, and so that's not a bad place to be. It's not as high as private equity, but it's a strong performer. And then fixed income is our other liquid asset class, or most liquid asset class, where, as Marcus described, our ability to rebalance during times of dislocation and being able to sell fixed income securities and buy public equities during times of dislocation, it enhances the bounce when you have recoveries. So it is, I think, important to maintain discipline. And Marcus has some great stories about Yale and Dave Swenson, one of the original private equity believers, and they benefited hugely. But he always argued for 30% liquid assets, you know. And when he passed away, within 4 or 5 years, they diminished their liquid assets significantly, and now they're suffering. They don't have the ability to sell liquid assets to provide for cash flow. They've got to try to sell illiquid assets. And so there's valuable lessons, and it requires a constant disciplined approach.
But the thing that would benefit is, like, the current model, the metric that's important for funding availability is statutory net income. And we don't manage to statutory net income. It's not in our mandate. The board hasn't told us maximize statutory net income. So, like, we own Tysons Corner Mall in D.C., which is a high-performing mall. Even though malls aren't great today, that is one of the top malls in the country. It generates over $100 million a year in cash flow. We've got a multi-$100 million gain because we bought that mall in the 80s. And that, unless we sell that gain will never go into statutory net income. It'll never be available to sell, but we have a very thorough appraisal process that shows what that mall is worth. And in a percent of market value framework, you can spend 5% of that value that's independently calculated, whereas statutory net income, it's just like we've never made money on that investment when it's been one of our top investments, and we don't want to sell it. And so we don't manage the statutory net income, but if you're a decision maker thinking about asset allocation or any number of topics, it's hard to ignore that unrealized gains are not available for any of the people that rely on our fund to run the state. So,
yeah, thanks. That's a pretty good explanation, I think, for I'm mostly asking for not us so much as people that are watching. So we don't want to sell the mall if it's making a lot of money, because it's making a lot of money, but if we had to sell it, we'd have to sell it to fund our $1,000. Never mind.
So I recognize that we have a few slides on performance and market outcomes, and I really did want to get to those today. I am going to take just a very brief at ease to do a little quick planning with the committee members on timeline, and then we'll be back on record. At ease. House State Affairs is back on the record. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair. So, I want to look at a slightly different aspect of what we're going to be doing with the resolution and perhaps the amendment, and that is that, as I understand it right now, if we go to the full 5% and if we're managing the fund to inflation plus 5%, we're essentially saying that the fund value, absent any new money going into it, is now a fixed fund in real dollars. Right? 5% plus inflation, and if we distribute 5%,
I get you.
And we only put keep inflation, then we now are managing to a fixed fund. We're basically now fixed income retirees, mm-hmm. and we're assuming that our lifestyle can do that, which means that if our population grows in our state, if we have new demands on our state government, we're kind of stuck because we've now flatlined our fund. We'll have to dilute that against more people that want dividends. We'll have to dilute that if we have more kids that want to go to school and need BSA payments, that we're going to manage it to, this is how big it is, but that is as big as it will ever get for future generations. We'll just make sure that it stays in real dollars, has the same real purchasing power, absent any new money coming into it. Mm-hmm. I get that. So I want to make sure, A, that I'm kind of getting it, that that would be what we'd be committing to at 5%. Manage 5% plus, we're basically saying, that's as big as it got, guys. This was our heyday, and it'll be a good thing long term. So where I'm going with my question is, what's your view of what are we doing with the way we're managing our decision about what other revenue goes into the corpus in terms of other resource development allocations under the current constitution that puts a certain portion of our income in there? And should we, at this point in time, if we're going to have a constitutional amendment that restructures this, is there something that the Board of Trustees sees that we ought to do on the other side of what we're allocating and deciding that goes into the fund? So maybe we think about how this fund has some growth potential down the road that might keep up with the growth of our state, as opposed to being 2025, we basically said we're done. Because, you know, I think as we look at natural resource development, the heyday of the big dollars is probably over. We'll have new resource development, and it'll put some money in there. But I don't think we're ever going to see what we saw with the big oil boom on state land. So I'm looking for any recommendations that are coming from the trustees or thoughts that we should be considering. If we're going to have a vote and make a few little changes, is there something else that is on the income side that you think would be helpful and strategic in terms of the life of this fund and what it means to our state in the future that might align itself better with a state that maybe has some growth in the future and is actually growing the fund in a way that might keep up with our growth of our state, as opposed to becoming now a flatline thing that if our state doubled in size, the fund would still be where it was in 2025? Mm-hmm. Sorry for the long question, but I hope I kind of got my point out there mostly.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Holland, you are correct. Right now you have a constitution that requires at least 25% of royalty revenue flow into the permanent fund. And then by statute, oil fields that started producing after 1978 also have that, the state has that royalty revenue also flow into the permanent fund. And so you could consider constitutionalizing that something closer to 50% of royalty revenue goes into the permanent fund. In the modeling that Ledge Finance did, they had an interesting chart on their last page that showed the draw rate at 5.5, draw rate at 4.5. And like I said earlier, there was a convection point where those draw rates crossed and the 4.5 starts exceeding the 5.5 in about 20 years. And so to the extent you wanted to provide for the potential of increase spending in the future, you would have a lower draw rate today. Mm-hmm. Again, those are all policy decisions that the needs, why the state spent the money in the 1960s that it got from that initial lease sale was that the needs were so great. Mm-hmm. State was poor. I mean, it was easy to spend that money because there were so many needs. So it's a matter of providing both for the people of today. You can't neglect that whole, you don't want to let too many fish go up the river because then it's not good for the ecosystem either. You want to catch enough that you get your fair share. But so it's a balance. And I think that the markets have shown that maybe 5% is a fair balance. It's 4.5 is a fair balance, and it's an easier target. It has a lower probability of failure from a risk assessment perspective, and it provides for some growth in the future, but ultimately that's your decision.
Representative Vance, is it a brief question?
It is a brief question.
Okay, very brief.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Back to the modeling that's been done on whether or not we should change the 25% in the Constitution to 50%. Would you be able to provide us that modeling if, rather than it going to the general fund, the other percentage going to the general fund, putting it into the permanent fund, because we're still going to receive that through the draw, right? Has modeling been done on that? And if so, could you get that to the committee for next week?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I believe that Ledge Finance included additional royalty deposits into the fund in their modeling that they did. And so I think that would be your best source, is just pulling that down off Senate Finance's hearing from today, or get it just directly from Lexi. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Frampton, for your great question and answer today and presenting HJR 10 to us. Just to reiterate on the record for committee members, we are setting HJR 10 aside today. Next Tuesday, we are hearing the resolution again and taking public testimony. I'm also setting an amendment deadline for House Joint Resolution 10 of 5 p.m. Wednesday, April 30th. So please note that, and we will also send that out to committee members. At this time, we're going to take a brief at ease to transition to our final bill of the day, House Bill 152 from Representative Galvin. Brief at ease. House State Affairs is back on the record, and the last item on our agenda today is House Bill 152, an education head tax proposal from Representative Galvin. Thank you for being here to walk us through intro presentation of House Bill 152 today. Just for committee members' information, my intention is to bring this legislation back up next week, so I'd like to let the sponsor go through the presentation and hold some questions. And we do also have an invited testifier, so I'd like to try to get through those things this afternoon. Thank you, Representative Galvin.
All right. Well, thank you. For the record, this is Elise Galvin, a representative of District 14, and I want to thank you, Chair Carrick, for the opportunity to speak with you and to the committee today about an issue that lies at the very heart of our state's future success: a quality education for Alaska's children. Alaska has a constitutional responsibility to provide a quality education for all Alaskans, and if we're honest, we're not meeting that standard right now. Underfunded schools, overworked teachers, and students left without the resources they need, it's a crisis that we can't ignore any longer. We also can't ignore the structural deficit and can't expect us to irresponsibly draw from our savings to save us from this fiscal cliff. So I'm here to introduce House Bill 152, a practical, balanced, and forward-looking solution that will help Alaska fund its public education system in a sustainable way. Alaska has had education taxes in the past, and for decades, we've been fortunate. Oil and gas revenues carried us, funding government operations, building up the permanent fund, and allowing us to invest in our future. But that chapter is closing. The revenue from oil and gas is shrinking, and the math just doesn't add up anymore. So luckily, the earnings from our permanent fund, and you just heard about that just a few minutes ago, they still do play a critical role, but they are alone not enough. It's time to look at other responsible ways to fill the gap between what we bring in and what we must invest to keep our economy and our schools strong. Now, HB 152 proposes two steps. Firstly, a $150 per person education head tax for anyone who earns wages or self-employed income. Secondly, a 4% flat income tax on individual earnings would be taxed on the dollar amounts over $150,000 or dollar amounts over $300,000 if you are filing jointly. And that's the AGI, so your adjusted gross income. This bill also closes a significant loophole, what's often called the S-Corp loophole. Currently, S-corporations and their owners avoid paying any state income tax on profits. HB 152 ensures that income, just like wages, is treated fairly when it exceeds the threshold that we've placed in this bill. And it doesn't just apply to Alaskan residents. Importantly, anyone who earns money in Alaska, resident or non-resident, will contribute their fair share toward the system that makes our communities stronger and more attractive to families and businesses alike. When we invest in education, we invest in everything: our workforce, our economy, and our shared future. My sense is if we don't act now, another generation of students will pay the price. HB 152 is not just a tax bill. It's a commitment. It is time that we have an honest conversation about how Alaska will fund education in a fiscally responsible and sustainable manner. So today, I ask you to join me. Let's move forward with a plan that's very responsible and deeply Alaskan. And at this point, I'm going to shift to the presentation that you have electronically. And it's going to be a few slides. And I will be presenting, and my staffer also will be presenting a few of the slides. He'll introduce himself as we rotate speaking. I want to make sure that he has a chance also to speak to some of the more intricate pieces of this bill. As you know, any form of a revenue bill like this is quite complicated, and I want to make sure that we step through it carefully so that you understand the mechanisms and also what mechanisms could be changed if you so choose. All right, here we go. So at a very high level, this is a preview of what we're going to cover. It's a brief agenda for our presentation. We're first going to go a very macro scope and describe what the bill does and what it doesn't do. Then we're going to briefly put into context the overall fiscal challenge we're all facing. I will describe the education income tax structure in general, including some of the options when putting one in place. I'll go over the options I chose for this particular bill, for the introduced version, its provisions, and the implementation costs and issues. And David also then will provide a sectional analysis if you wish, Chair Carrick, but we can wait on that for later if there's not time. And then we're happy to answer questions. So as I said previously, we are approaching a fiscal cliff and the need to act now on a long-term. Let's see, we're going to move this. Mm-hmm. And we'll keep up here. We're now on slide three. There we go. As I said previously, we are approaching a fiscal cliff and the need to act now on a long-term fiscal plan. I support a broad-based revenue source as part of a sustainable fiscal plan to provide adequate funding for a high-quality education for our children. Primarily, I see a broad-based revenue source as a revenue stabilizer. Given our continuing dependence on the highly volatile revenue from oil, finally, I'm introducing HB 152 because I believe that for the reasons I will get into shortly, an income tax is a better choice for Alaska than a sales tax. HB 152 is one step in the goal of changing our dialogue about education from a state doing more with less to having enough to reach excellence. We all know teachers are underpaid. We've seen the analysis there. And they're overworked in Alaska. And schools have to make very tough and heartbreaking decisions whether to eliminate a particular class so the hockey or basketball team don't shut down, all the while making sure that there are enough funds at the end of the day to fund schools that are breaking down. HB 152 opens our options to find a more sustainable way to fund our schools. There are two main levers to the education tax. First, as I mentioned earlier in my sponsor statement, is the head tax. The head tax on all wage and income earners. Furthermore, it establishes a flat income tax on the individual annual income on the dollar amounts above $150,000 or joint annual above $300,000, and that's of the adjusted gross income on your federal tax form. I introduce HB 152 to serve as a vehicle to discuss the role of an income tax in the sustainable fiscal plan for education. I'm hoping we can soon put in place. Through HB 152, we can discuss the relative merits of wages earnings tax versus a sales tax, as well as the adjustments that can be made to a tax proposal depending on the desires of the committee. It's important to note what HB 152 does not do. So you'll see here, we're not going to raise any revenue for this coming year. It's not going to solve the problem that we have right now in this building, unfortunately, just because it takes a bit to get it in place. Secondly, it's not going to solve Alaska's fiscal crisis on its own. This is one of the many pieces that were suggested, and I'll get into that a bit later. Thirdly, this is not going to burden Alaska's economy. I think that's important to note as well. It will not push people away from working in Alaska, which I know is a concern that many of you have had. Stabilizing, and then the next thing I want to mention is that oil revenues have dropped. In case you haven't seen the newspaper, our savings accounts have been depleted, and we've cut the state budget significantly. It is widely recognized that in our situation, a broad-based revenue source is the best collection of difficult options that we have before us. They're all difficult, but we have to do something, and I believe this is the best choice. I want to point out again that it is becoming generally accepted that a broad-based tax is needed in Alaska. And I also want to mention that we've had within this building, the 32nd Legislature had the Bipartisan Fiscal Policy Working Group. And I want to nod now to one of the members and thank Representative McCabe for being a part of that. And they had joint findings. One of them recommended was the adoption of a broad-based revenue measure. As you can see, the broad-based tax fortifies the traditional three-legged stool that is Alaska's economy. It's good to have an extra leg to give support should one of the legs be impacted or weakened. As broad-based revenue measures go, in my opinion, as well as that of many tax and economic experts, for Alaska, an income tax is preferable to a sales tax in funding education for a variety of reasons. Sales taxes are more regressive, meaning that they take a larger portion of income from poorer Alaskans and hit them harder. I'm not looking to take food off the table from families. That's not the goal of this bill, and I'll explain it as we get into the details. There are a variety of sales taxes already in place among Alaska's municipalities. Adding a sales tax creates adding on top, which is complicated, and we can avoid that with an income tax. In fact, I want to make sure that you note that in Ketchikan and in Bethel, already the sales tax are in the teens, so they're 13 and 16%. So you could imagine adding a sales tax on top of that could be complicated. So because of the regional price differences as well, a sales tax will disproportionately negatively affect rural Alaska. In my opinion, we're better off taxing the wages of non-resident workers who will be taxed higher anyways in their home states than visiting tourists who otherwise would spend money at our local businesses to share the tax burden without secondary impacts on Alaska's economy. I'm going to now shift over to my staff, David, who will get into some of the details of this.
For the record, this is David Chang, staff to Representative Galvin. So what we see here on the slide, this is an example from a presentation given back in 2021 by a legislative consultant group, ITEP, or the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. is here to provide a visual representation of the regressive nature of sales tax in comparison to income tax. Here, they show how two revenue measures that each generate $500 million in revenue is impacted across different Alaskans from the lowest income shown on the left to high earners shown on the right. As you can see, the sales tax shown in the yellow bars impact the lowest income Alaskans more, while an income tax shown by the gray bars hit the higher incomes, impacts higher income Alaskans. However, lower income Alaskans spend a larger portion of their earnings on groceries and household goods than higher income, and the sales tax would disproportionately impact low income Alaskans in their ability to put food on the table, in especially a state with such a high cost of living. Using this example's numbers, taking 2.2% from the lowest income Alaskans affects their lives far more than taking an extra 2.8% from the highest earning. So, how does one design a tax? This slide illustrates that there are a variety of models that can be used as a starting point, the chassis of the tax, if you will. Once you select a model, then you'll have to choose among a variety of levers or gears that can be tweaked depending on how you want the tax to function. There are a lot of levers to pull, many questions to ask, like whether there's a standard deduction, what's the tax rate, should there be a head tax, is there already a local tax in that community? You get the idea. This slide shows the full array of income that could be subject to an income tax. Each proposal will choose which of these types of income will be subject to the tax. Once you have selected that model, there are more decisions to make. So here's just a list of what income sources can be encompassed. Do you take wages and salaries, investment income, take them separate or together? One thing I'll just note is that the PFD is exempted in statute from the definition of taxable income. So to simplify the choices and the impact on taxpayers, most states have built their income tax off of the pre-existing components found in the federal tax system, and the numbers are generated on the taxpayer's federal income tax return. In calculating one's federal income tax, one starts with all of their income for the year and makes adjustments based on what is considered taxable by the federal government. That results in your adjusted gross income, or AGI. Most states use AGI as the basis for their state income tax. On the federal return, the AGI is reduced through either a standard deduction or an itemized deduction to get your taxable income. Some states use the federal taxable income as the starting point for their income tax to simplify that process, as was aforementioned. Back on the federal return, the federal taxable income is charged against the federal tax table to determine the federal taxes due. Another option is for states to simply calculate the state income tax liability as a percentage of the federal tax liability. So, as you can see, there are three options as a structure for a state income tax. Now I'll turn it back to Representative Galvin.
So now you have a sense of the many things that we had to choose from. And I'll tell you what, we started also with how much money do we want to raise? And you'll hear more about that in slide 21, but this is a reason for you to stay awake because the answer is going to surprise you. But meanwhile, I'm going to tell you about the options that we chose. Firstly, to keep it simple, we stuck with the federal adjusted gross income tax. So as you can see there, that makes it easier for when you're trying to fill out your form. I didn't feel a need to reinvent the wheel here. Another option is to decide on a standard deduction or a series of complicated itemized deductions. We chose the standard deduction, largely because we could set it at $150,000, again, for a single filer, or $300,000 for joint filers to structure my proposal in a way to maximize support. Third option concerns whether to have a graduated tax rate going up as in increased your income increases, or a flat tax rate. We chose simple flat tax rate of 4%. Finally, we chose to include a $150 head tax as well.
Representative Galvin, we do have a question. Representative McCabe?
You can move on. I can wait till the end. I have a few things to ask. It's fine.
Okay. Sorry. Please continue.
No worries. Okay. We will move on to this exciting slide 16, which really brings home the point that 152 as proposed, will only tax the 4% on dollar amounts above $150,000. So as you can see from the examples of four different taxpayers, so Alaskan person A, for example, with a $50,000 income is going to pay $150 education tax, as will the Alaskan with a $100,000 annual income. So person A and person B are both going to pay $150. Person C, there you can see with a $200,000 income, they pay the flat tax of $150, plus they pay 4% of the dollars above their the $150. So they're paying 4% of the $50,000, which is $2,000. And then they add that, the $150, that becomes $2,150. Someone earning $500,000 will pay 4% of the $500,000, so a total of $14,150.
For the record, this is David Jang, staff to Rep. Galvin. So this slide here on technical answers some of the technical provisions that need to be considered, such as the provision that the tax is paid by both non-resident and resident earners alike on income earned in the state, as well as whether the tax applies to trusts and estate income. It does for House Bill 152, the employer responsibility in withholding wages and sending W-2s, just all these small kind of technical details. Just for the interest of time, I'll be moving on, but happy the representative and I are happy to address any questions if there are any.
And I'm going to add, too, that this is important to note. Oh, pardon me. I will go ahead and move on to the next slide. I'll add more later.
So this slide addresses the costs related to implementing the tax. The main costs are capital costs to implement the infrastructure and software on the Department of Revenue's end to collect this income tax. Employer costs are minimal since they already report employee data to the Department of Labor. We've designed the education tax to have as little paperwork burden as possible. Only a quarter of Alaska households would have earnings high enough to pay that 4% tax. Furthermore, paying the Alaska state income tax would simply use the same tax preparation methods used in filing federal taxes as listed here, like TurboTax, a CPA accountant, etc. And I will turn this back to Rep. Galvin.
Thank you. For the record, Elise Galvin, representing District 14. So this helps us get a better look of the non-resident workers, have a good sense of how many and what to expect. And my numbers are a bit old. I want to make sure to note that so far the resources that you see go up to 2023. So let's take a look at the growing impact of the workers in Alaska. Since 2020, the percentage of non-resident workers has risen significantly from 18.3% to a record high of 22.5% in 2023. This trend is especially notable in the oil and gas industry, where non-residents now make up 37.4% of the workforce. On the North Slope, that figure climbs to even higher, to 45%. Now, why does this matter? Well, the oil and gas sector is the highest paying industry in the state, with an average annual wage of over $180,000. There are also a substantial number of workers on the North Slope, with two projects, Willow and Pica, managing over 4,000 employees in their construction phases. I want to remind you, these workers are paying taxes at home currently, higher taxes. They will be paying the 4% here and then deducting it. They will not be double taxed. They will be paying less taxes here and then deducting it from their home state taxes. This brings us to House Bill 152. I want to remind you again, it targets only the high earners. Importantly, non-residents receive credit for this tax. No double taxing again, like I said. And their earnings are, they're only paying taxes once on their earnings here in Alaska. As a committee, you may want to move some of the levers and try out different options. One significant lever is the size of the standard deduction that is currently set at $150,000. If that were to be reduced, say, to $75,000, meaning any dollar income dollar amounts over $75,000 would be subject to the 4% education income tax. Then it would be projected to raise an additional $250 million. In the other direction, if the education head tax, for example, were to be reduced from $150 to $100 per person, the program would bring in $24 million less. And I'm going to add here, since I don't see it in our slides, I don't think you've seen it. Currently, this is predicted to raise between $250 and $300 million. And if you add in the head tax, it gets up to $350 million. So in recap, I believe that it's time for Alaska to have a sustainable plan to fund education. And HB 152, a broad-based education tax, sparks that dialogue to get the ball rolling. We look forward to working with you in House State Affairs to further strengthen this bill and earn your support. And we look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Representative Galvin and staff, David Jang. And we did have one invited testifier. And so given our very limited time today, I'm going to ask that our invited testifier have about 5 minutes to speak at most. And then we will have to set the bill aside and reserve discussion for our next hearing. So at this time, I'd like to invite Mr. Brett Watson with ICER in Anchorage to please provide a 5 minute or less testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair Carrick, for the opportunity to speak on the bill this afternoon. For the record, my name is Brett Watson, and I'm an economist at the Institute of Social and Economic Research. ICER has had a long history of evaluating fiscal policy, including proposed revenue legislation like the bill that's before you at the committee today. I have had an opportunity to conduct a back-of-the-envelope calculation on the revenue that this measure might raise for the state over the short term. There was also a fiscal note attached to the bill that Department of Revenue conducted that estimated that this bill would raise somewhere between $300 and $350 million in the short run based on existing public data. My estimates place that revenue estimate somewhat lower than DOR's estimate, but I think not low enough to cause alarm. My estimate suggests that the state could raise in the short term between $200 and $270 million. As the bill sponsors mentioned in their testimony this afternoon, about $67 million of that would come from the head tax portion of the bill, with a balance coming from the income tax portion of the bill. This analysis obviously is quite simplistic given the limited nature of publicly available data on tax filing situations in the state of Alaska, given that the state currently has no income tax. We don't have any income tax filing records for Alaskans. That's a limitation from analysis of this, and obviously a limitation of DNR's fiscal note analysis as well. I'll also note that these analyses are limited by their static nature, meaning that no dynamic effects are incorporated into them, so we're not accounting for how people might potentially respond to the imposition of the tax in their labor market behavior. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak to the bill this afternoon, and I'd be happy to take any questions that the committee has.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Watson, and I hope that you'll be able to join us next week as we hear this bill and take up committee discussion on it. I know there's probably a pretty robust discussion we could have, and I'd kind of like to reserve that for next week, as opposed to trying to get into it with very little time left today. So at this time, we will set House Bill 152 aside. Thank you again to Representative Galvin and staff for presenting the legislation. And that will conclude our business for House State Affairs today. Our next meeting will be on Tuesday, April 29th at 3:15 here in Room 120. The current agenda for that meeting is as follows. We will first take up House Bill 1 from Representative McCabe on gold and silver specie. We will then take up House Joint Resolution 10 on constitutionalizing the POMV draw from Representative Schrage and take public testimony. We will then take up House Concurrent Resolution 2, the Uniform Rules Abstention Change from Rep. Mears, and take up any amendments. And finally, do, as time allows, an introductory hearing on House Bill 170 on reporting violent crimes from Representative Burke. With no further business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 5:06 p.m.